How can we limit the powers of the presidency? That's today's conversation with our co-host, Ryan from Between the Liars, and our guest of the hour, A.K. Kamara, starting with the debate, the need for a pluralistic executive system, and creating boundaries on executive orders. I'm your host, Ken Drew, and this is Taboo Topic. Keep up to date with the latest content through social media. Type in the search bars of Instagram, Getter, Truth Social, and TikTok, mainly those first three of Instagram, Getter, or Truth Social, Kenjin underscore Express. I repeat, Kenjin underscore Express. Spell the word engine, then put the letter K in front of the word engine, then you get Kenjin, one word, underscore Express. You can also follow this show on Facebook just by typing in the search bar of Taboo Topic. Look for the logo that says Honesty Equals Understanding. You can listen to this show on any platform from Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google, and even Amazon, which, by the way, please don't forget to give this show a rating and review. If it's anything less than a 5-star, let me know so I can better serve you. Last but not least, you can find the inspirations for the Wednesday's episodes on my Substack newsletters. Type in the URL at kenjin296.substack.com if you want a visual of the inspiration and you want that script to see what will the episode on Wednesday shall be focused on. Share this with your friends and family members, because here on this show, we dare to think out loud and question the narrative. Free speech triumphs safe space, because in order for us to think, we have to risk being offensive. If we want true peace in our society, we have to be able to be honest with each other, without judgment. If we can be honest with each other, then we can achieve real peace in our society. Amen. Inspire Tees is a Christian-owned business that sells inspirational and Christian-themed t-shirts, available in many sizes and colors. Our tees are for men and women, and many are unisex in selection. Inspire Tees is a woman-owned and operated business, as well as Inspire Tees supports veterans, military personnel, and police. When you purchase a tee from their Veterans and Military Department, the American category, 10% of those profits go to the Wounded Warrior Project. So please check the company out, Inspire Tees, and support that company and the sponsor of this episode. Now I want to give a quick shout out to the New York City Podcast Network. Listen, the people in that company have been very supportive and even chose a few episodes of Taboo Topic as their favorite pick from the staff. This community, to put into context, has over 800 podcasts they can listen to. So it's humbling that at least one person from their staff thought an episode from Taboo Topic should be recognized. Guess what? You can also help with that by heading over to the New York City Podcast Network.com. Look for the show Taboo Topic and hit the upvote button on the show and the episodes. The more people upvote, the more it reaches out to. So please head on over to the New York City Podcast Network.com and their shows, but more importantly, support this show by hitting the upvote button and on the show, Taboo Topic, and the episodes. This is a reminder that the Biden administration abandoned 9,000 to 15,000 Americans in Afghanistan. Now, you won't hear about this from the media, or any politician for that matter, because the global elite have their own agenda that disregards human life and basic human dignity. So, to the families and individuals that have been affected by this abandonment, know that you have not forgotten. Most Americans, like myself, know, or your loved ones, didn't choose to stay behind. If there's any way I can further help besides bring awareness, reach out at Kenjin underscore Express. I repeat, Kenjin underscore Express on Instagram. Spell the word engine, put the letter K in front of the word engine, then you get Kenjin, one word, underscore Express. If you have, by one in a millionth chance, hear this message. It's not much, but know this. Justice will be served for those who lied to justify their incompetence. After all, I believe in God, who is in control of all things, and he says, vengeance is mine. Now, let's get back to the show.
Hello, everyone. everyone. Hello. Welcome to another edition of Blueprint. I am the host of Taboo Topic with my usual co-host, Ryan from Between the Lines. How are you, sir?
Doing great.
And you may, and you may have noticed, folks, we have a third guest. We have a third person for today's episode because, frankly, talking about the president is a complicated matter, and there's a reason why the Founding Fathers left it pretty vague in its language. So we figured, well, let's have a third person here to kind of help us out with this, today's conversation. Without further ado, AK Kamara, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, what's going on, man? What's up, everybody? So thank you for having me, first and foremost. I love having meaningful, impactful conversations about the political realm, man. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so I don't know how much you know about Blueprint or anything like that, but I guess for anyone who's new to the show as well, or new to the segment, special series, whatever you want to call it, more or less, it's like a miniature convention of constitutional convention, essentially. So instead of just kind of complaining about the problems and everything like that, we look at the problem itself, and then we discuss practical solutions. We can actually kind of give people a visual as far as like what would be an ideal form of government that we would like to have. So that best represents us anyway. So we just, the first month actually went over Congress. That took about, 4 weeks, Ryan. I think the first episode was probably our longest one so far. And then we just finished up the judicial branch. And so the judicial branch only took us 2 weeks because Ryan and I pretty much agreed on pretty much just leaving the judicial branch alone as far as at the federal level, leave it as is with left appointments. The only thing we added was really, if Ryan can recall, was the fact that we just decided that there needed to be a constitutional amendment to protect the continuity of having 9 justices at the Supreme Court to avoid a scenario of court packing. So, Ryan, does that pretty much sum it up?
Yeah, dude, hit it right on the head. Like you said, didn't change a whole lot there.
Yeah, but today's conversation, we're actually going to go ahead and talk about the executive branch, more specifically the president, which, let's be honest, America, next to Congress, is probably like the most disapproval, highest disapproval ratings next to Congress is the president himself. We can argue whether the validity of the polls, whether between Donald Trump and Joe Biden is legitimate or not. But as far as right now, the last two presidents, especially, I don't think a single president from either one of those have even reached, have even broke like 55% approval rating since Obama in like in the early 2010s when he first got into office. They got like a high approval rating. So, but that didn't last. So let's go ahead and talk about quickly our sentiments with the presidents and everything like that. And I'll start off with our guest, AK Kamara. Like, what are your personal sentiments about the how our current president system is running right now?
Yeah, so I think that the executive office has way too much power. You know, the precedent of using executive order from what I believe its intentions were to where we are now. Basically, if the president feels that there's something that they can't get through congressional approval or they think it will take too long, they just start writing executive orders. And if you kind of look back through history, right, starting kind of with President Bush, Clinton wrote a decent amount of executive orders as well, but Bush kind of like took it to a whole new level. it's continued to just scale up and up and up. And even Donald Trump, he did a lot of executive orders as well. And I just think it's too much power, man. I think that the reason that we have this system that we have where we can have checks and balances is important. It's fundamental to having a constitutional republic. And right now, there's just been so much abuse and you can't point fingers at any one person. You really can't. It's that the way that the system doesn't really have any guardrails. And that's what the issue is, in my opinion. And I just think it's a bad form of government in which an executive can unilaterally just write insane types of policies that have financial impacts across the board. And that's what's been happening.
Ryan, what are your thoughts?
No, I agree. I have to amend a little bit of my statement from our last segment, which was, I know that President Obama was called the pen and phone president. He used a lot of executive orders. And I was looking at the numbers. I didn't dive too deeply into these. But from what I saw at a surface level cursory glance, Donald Trump did like 55 executive orders, which almost came up to par with just under President Obama's 2 terms. And then Joe Biden did 50 in the first 3 weeks. So we're just kind of blowing out, like AK was saying, what is that use? And I will say the hallmark of President Biden's administration and him in particular with his executive orders has been, I don't care whether it's constitutional, I'm going to do it because there will be quote unquote net good, again, determined by him as the arbiter of truth there before the courts can strike it down. You saw this when it came to the moratorium on evictions. You saw this with the forgiveness of student loan debts, which is just a transition of that student loan debt. And even if it gets struck down, you're already seeing that either the damage or the good has been done. And that's kind of where the executive orders are. It is important to note that they're not law, but they're treated as law. They're an interpretation of the law. And unless the states pass something to counteract it or the courts strike it down, again, takes time and consensus, it's going to be a law.
Now, why do you guys think the founding fathers left the original language in the Constitution to be so vague when it came to the powers of the presidency? What are your personal sentiments?
Yeah, I'll take a jump at it first. So we do have an executive for a reason. There are certain things that the president has to have the authority to execute quickly and efficiently. So I think that there's when you think about the way that our system is set up and how our senators were originally elected by our House of Representatives, right? Instead of each individual state. I think that there was a greater idea that there'd be more check and also more back and forth between executive legislative branches. So that's kind of why I think they left it vague. I was kind of looking at a few things, especially from Jefferson talking about the powers of the executive and then looking at writings from Madison. And they understood that the executive has to be able to do certain things, but within a narrow scope, because we didn't want another king. We didn't want a monarch. But I just don't think they foresaw that under the current structure, under the structure that they created, that we would have so much power that could accumulate, especially when you don't have pushback from the other house, from the other branch, from the legislative branch. So that's kind of my two cents, is that the original structure didn't give this much power, and kind of the first chink in that armor is when we moved the way that we elect our senators. I think that that really took away a lot of power from the people and kind of gave more power to the controlling party.
Brian, what do you think?
Well, AK took the words right out of my mouth. I can really only add to that. I think that where technology has advanced, I think that that's also changed it, and the way the political game has shifted, starting with like he mentioned, the way that we elect our senators, but also what do we think the job of each of these is? And that's really self-decreed, right? And so we're seeing that the president thinks, okay, well, Congress isn't getting anything done, instead of looking at why do we have such a close race between the two parties that we're essentially gridlocked, and then how can we coalition build and make sure that we pass things that are more moderate, is instead, well, they elected me as president. Therefore, instead of thinking maybe some people voted because they liked me just better than the other guy, but I was also a garbage choice, I clearly get to push through my whole agenda. And so they're then taking this as, well, I have to get something done. And then they also are politically motivated to do so, coming up on a midterm. Like, there's a reason he waited until 10 weeks before midterm elections to do what he had campaigned on as a promise. And then just for the technological aspects, who gets to declare war? It's Congress. The president can send in troops for 30 days. And then at that point, if Congress doesn't declare war, then you're in violation. But what did President Obama do? He just bombed the hell out of Libya and other countries because he sent in drones. He's like, well, this isn't a declaration of war. So, like, technically, they're just shifting the way that the power can be utilized and flying supposedly under the radar. But I really start to think we've pushed away not only the original intent of the Constitution, but also, you're kind of really declaring war if you're continuing to bomb countries. I mean, to an extent, it just depends on how you define war. So, really, right. I think we've shifted and we've played semantical games in order to allow this power to continue to grow. And I also think there's a large level of apathy where people are like, as long as it doesn't affect me personally, right? Like, I think part of the reason Donald Trump was so negatively reviewed was because he made it everybody else's problem. Like, he was always on Twitter. He always made himself available. President Obama did a lot of things that were, lots of potential war crimes, same for Bush, but people don't pay attention to it, right? And I think that to us, it's like, as long as I don't hear about the captain of the ship, I don't care.
I mean, that's fair. And that's something that, you guys brought up as far as once upon a time when founding fathers had this conversation or something like that, the anti-federalists, they were concerned about how our executive power anyway was concerned that it would become, based on how it's set up right now, it would become an elective monarch, an elective king. And this And I guess pretty much all of us can agree that's what's become with this sport. It's an elective king with the amount of power it has. Actually, like, there's an actual debate that it wasn't like a huge debate, but they actually debated in the Convention of States, or Convention of States, Constitutional Convention back in 1787 to decide whether or not they wanted to do a singular executive power versus a plural executive power, which, for those who may not be aware, the difference between an executive and a plural system, let's use Texas, because Texas is the best example of a plural system, where essentially you can have executive branches, and imagine the executive branch, you have the governor, you have the lieutenant governor, you have the attorney general, right? Just think about those three positions. Instead of the governor appointing like the attorney general, the people actually elect the attorney general. So it could be it's possible to have like a Republican governor while having like a Green Party attorney general, essentially. That's the difference between a plural executive power versus a singular executive power, where the singular executive power, the president would actually, or the governor, you know, would have the power to appoint people in cabinet positions that best represents his values and his views. The founding fathers thought that would be too much of a problem, so they went with the singular executive power. And I'm assuming that all of us are probably on the same page as far as, like, if there's going to be any changes, that's not one of those things we're going to change. Ryan, AK, what are your thoughts on that real quick?
Yeah, I would, Minnesota's the same way. So we have our constitutional officers, attorney general, secretary of state, state auditor, and lieutenant governor. They can be split, but, you know, most of the time they all kind of go with the same party. But Minnesota's interesting. We have not had a Republican attorney general since like the 70s, like 1970s. So even when all the other constitutional offices, you know, governor, secretary of state, state auditor, they all switched to Republican or Democrat. Attorney general, for some weird reason, has maintained like in Democrat hands for a long time. And I do think that that actually is something that, you know, would be something to really talk about in regards to scaling back, because again, it adds an additional layer. I know that most of the time it's going to go with the way that the ticket goes. But if you really have a terrible candidate, and we know, okay, we have this president coming in, and there's a lot of, you know, if you want to say, there's always a bunch of rumors, and people are writing stories about who's going to be in the new executive's cabinet, right? Like, who do you think they're going to pick for this? Who are they going to pick for this? And it'd be nice to let know, like, hey, this is exactly who they're going to pick, and you have to vote on them. Like, how awesome would that be? And I still get that at the end of the day, it's this conversation that goes back to how much power should an executive truly have? And I just think that we're at a point where our executive branch 100% has too much power that is unchecked. Even just kind of a little bit of a side tangent, you know, there is news about Trump saying that, you know, if he decides to run and if he gets elected, that he's going to do the Schedule F, right? That all of these federal employees can be on the chopping block so he can get rid of them. And people lose their mind. And to me, that is just kind of a small way of taking a chink out of the bureaucracy of these unelected people that have so much power that, again, tie back to the executive branch, right, and little things like that. So I don't like having unchecked power, man. And our executive right. branch is so strong.
So would you be in favor of them doing something like a plural system for at the federal level then, it sounds
absolutely.
Like?
Absolutely. Absolutely. At the federal level would be amazing, man. It would be
interesting.
Awesome.
What do you think, Ryan?
So I would be, it would depend on the specifics, but I agree with AK that there is too much power. And to me, my perspective on government is the smaller the better, and the less they can get done, the better. I think that you should have more sweeping legislation, quote unquote sweeping, at the local level, right? I think that California needs to let Tennessee do their thing and vice versa. Like, there's a reason, you know, when you have 300 million people, 330 million people, that, you know, we don't all agree, obviously, and it goes regionally, because what happens in Minnesota, I didn't realize this till I moved there for my grad program for a while there, but like, Minnesota is way more like the South than Illinois is, or Chicago is, but then also the outskirts of Illinois is a lot more like those two, or Wisconsin than that, right? So like, it really goes more by it's really split more by, are you in the city, are you in the country, are you farmland, are you white collar, than it is, you know, these ideas. But I feel okay, that's taking us too far off the tangent. Sorry. So I think that the pluralistic system would better represent that to an extent. But I also see how, like, there are cabinet members that shouldn't be party based, right? Like, it's kind of like we've talked before how, like, you know, a sheriff shouldn't be like Republican, Democrat, but yet they do. And like, your ideas tend to kind of split, you know, based off of party lines. And I would hate to see those cabinet members be, you know, up for voting and then campaigning as hard with the parties as they would be. But I also sit here thinking, man, this system is a flaming dumpster. So like, how much worse could that possibly make it? And I was talking to Ken a little bit about this beforehand. There's a book called Team of Rivals. I haven't read about it, but like, we just discussed the premise of the book in one of my classes at one point. But the premise of the book, it was talking about how Abraham Lincoln wound up having his political rivals in his cabinet on purpose. And the idea there was that if I've got these people who are my political rivals right there, number one, I've made them a part of the team. You've kind of made them like, I guess you'd call them like bedfellows, right? Like people that you might not agree with, but you can try to make progress with. But also, it creates a level of transparency to where he has to perform to a higher level so that they don't call him out and vice versa. So I think that there is a lot of utility for that. So I see pros and cons. I would be open to a pluralistic system with maybe some specific guidelines, which I would love to talk about later on in this segment. But I'm open. I'll put it as that. I'm open.
I've been open to it as well. I guess my only concern is like when we think about like why we have the constitutional amendment to make sure like the vice president and the president were on the same ticket. It was because when John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were, you know, they're in office together, there was like a lot of friction between because they had two different political ideologies. And so they decided it'd be a lot easier if the, you know, they had the same ticket, same vision. And so for me anyway, what I would be concerned with the pluralistic system, if we just decided to start electing cabinet members, is that we do, let's say we do have a scenario where we elect an FBI agent who's a libertarian, but Joe Biden is a Democrat. I mean, if they both have like different ideologies and everything like that, and they both have like different ideas how the government system should function, could that create more dysfunction, I guess, and more bureaucracy? Now you can make the argument as far as, you know, well, with a libertarian, you probably wouldn't have the FBI going after raiding Donald Trump's home, probably most likely with the libertarian FBI director being elected into office. And that would have like create that account sense of accountability in the system. But let's go ahead and go for like, let's say the energy department. What, let's say Donald Trump were in office and there was a Democrat running the energy department or Green Party member running the energy department. Would we want to have that friction? What if the cabinet member in that position actually was more detrimental to the, wanted to come up with policies that are more detrimental to the American public, and Donald Trump didn't have any power because essentially that cabinet member has just as much power as the president at that point. So that'll be like my only concern. So I could probably like maybe compromise to something like if they were all on the ticket, like start including it. So if we're going to elect the president, like let the president actually like have like other people along with the VP on the ticket, so people know what they're voting for. At least that'd be like my compromise to like not going fully into a pluralistic system, but you know, at least if people have an idea, like what kind of policies are going to be voting in, they can do research on the cabinet members of the president that's on that ticket as well, that's going with the president into office. And then once they, if they get elected, like there's no surprises, like, okay, we know that this Joe Schmo, you know, that's running, Department of Homeland Security, these are his beliefs. We voted for this guy along with the president in this ticket. So I don't know. What do you guys think? What are y'all's thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I'll kind of, again, go back to the way that Minnesota's system is set up. Now, again, you know, we're talking about a national system.
Right.
And then the conversation starts to stray into how much power do we think the federal government should have? And
right.
I'm of the mind that I think way less power than it has right now. I think the things that it does that it should do that are constitutionally mandated that they do, they should do well. But there's so many things that the federal government has and people, especially nowadays, when you have conversations, the idea of like having states have power scares people. They're like, wait, what do you mean? Yeah. I'm like, some people don't even comprehend that different states like have different laws. And sometimes people say, well, why is it that this is a law here and not here? I'm like, because that's what people wanted in that state. And they're like, well, that should just be all federal. I'm like, see, this is the path we go down where it's like you got this one singular voice. To go to the point, though, to the question, in Minnesota, again, we have an attorney general that has been opposite the party because it's been a Democrat the entire time. And we've had we've had two Republican governors in that large span of time, and things still got done, right? Like the attorney general's office didn't fall apart because we had Republican Tim Pawlenty, and then we had Secretary of State and State Auditor that were also Republican, and then we had, you know, a Democrat that was Attorney General. Things still worked. And so, I would just push back and say, I like the idea of making sure that the executive branch even has checks in itself. And I think that that is a good thing. And I also think we have too many cabinets. So maybe you pare back, you know, how many departments there are and how many cabinet members there are. But this would require having a, you know, like you said, convention of the states and constitutional convention to change some things. But I just think that the more you can give opportunity to create less overarching power, I think that's important, because the executive branch, as the president, as the commander of the armed forces, like that is a lot of power. So it's like there's so many things that the president still would have power over that we want a commander in chief to have power over. But all these other things that he shouldn't actually, or she shouldn't actually have any power over, but they do right now. That's unchecked, in my opinion.
And I think, again, this goes back to the idea of what do the people expect of their president? Because so when I took over as the director of the Speech and Debate Union at Murray State, I was told by someone who used to oversee the team, her advice was, remember, you are the director. You don't have to do everything. You can delegate a lot of things. In fact, you do not have time, nor should you be doing everything, which means that when I was here before as the assistant director, I did all the coaching. Right. And that was what I was really, really good at. And now I'm more in an administrative role. I think the president really should be scaled back to more of the overseer. And that would also eliminate the need for all of these executive orders for micromanaging type things just because he or she thinks it's a good idea. It's not your job. It's not your purview. Right. So I think that kind of what AK was saying, maybe scaling things down, maybe removing some of these branches branches as in like all the cabinet members. But even branches like, OK, like do we need, you know, the FBI director to be a partisan issue, right? Like, I think right now the people's biggest concern is that it seems like it is an actor that is just a thug on behalf of the president, particularly with recent events. And I think that if they were directly voted for by the people instead of appointed by the president, you would remove a lot of that perception. Now, is that good or bad? I don't know, and I'm not going to say it this second. But I think that, you know, the more you allow people to directly vote on those things, the less they feel like it's a partisan hackery. But then you have a whole other slew of issues. I think it also depends. Are we talking about checks and balances where the president doesn't have unlimited power, but also the presidential office is above the rest of these, right? Because if you have a pluralistic system in which, you know, all 20 cabinets have the same level of power, then no, we're not going to get anything done. Now, is that good or bad? I don't know. It really depends. Now, in a crisis, it's going to be bad. But as far as, you know, the president being able to just levy executive orders that move $500 trillion of debt from one group of people to another, maybe that wouldn't be such a bad thing. It really depends on where you sit. So I think that, you know, the way that we would schedule this out in this, you know, thought experiment would really shift that. And I think to kind of go back to what you guys were saying a minute ago about putting people on the ticket, at least that level of transparency, if not letting them be directly voted for, right? If Donald Trump had to say, I'm putting these people, and you vote for me, these are the people that I will be appointing. It is my appointment. I picked these people, but you have that transparent vote, because maybe I would shift my vote for the president if I knew who some of the cabinet members were. Same for Joe Biden. You know, I'm really sorry to say this for people who think Pete Buttigieg was a great choice, but what were his qualifications to be, you know, the position that he was put into for a cabinet membership? He was so bad as governor of Indiana, Mayor Pete. Thank you. Mayor Pete, Domino's Pizza had to run a thing that they would use part of your funds to patch the roads because Mayor Pete couldn't handle that. How does that make him a good fit for something like transportation? It doesn't. Like, literally his qualifications were he likes choo-choo trains and, you know, he checks intersectional boxes. It's fine to have that representation. I'm not saying that that's a bad choice if that's what you want. But I can pretty well guarantee there were people who probably bit the bullet on Joe Biden because they didn't like Trump, who didn't think Pete Buttigieg represented them. Opening it up might shift the game a little bit and positively influence the way that they vote. I don't know.
But also you have to think about as far as like this, because we also believe that the way our system is set up anyway, like our system was meant for the people to mainly be concerned themselves with state issues, not federal issues.
Right.
So if we actually open that up to, at the federal level, do we want people to go ahead? Do we want people to start putting more focus at the federal level by, you know, focusing on like, all right, who's going to be running for attorney general at the federal level? Who's going to run for, you know, Department of Transportation at the federal level? Or do we want to go ahead and continue to keep that within the states, let the people let the main focus remain in the states and let the federal government, you know, leave that part alone and let, so we can actually remain consistent as far as like, we do believe that the people should concern more themselves with state and local issues. What do y'all think about that?
Yeah, I believe that the intention of what you're talking about is good because you want everyone to focus back on the states. The problem is that the states don't have the power that they should. And so it's like if we could start from scratch and say like, let's build a system, and that's kind of what we're talking about, right? Then I would say if we could make sure that the states retain the power that they should have, then this conversation completely changes. It does. But that's not what's going on. And so it's kind of like having this discussion of, is the fixes that we're wanting because the system right now is so broken in certain areas that these are the things that we would make sure that never impacted again. Because let's say we redo this whole thing, right? This Constitution of the United States, and we change a bunch of things, right? Would we be able to then still stop? Like, what stops could we put in that would stop the same trajectory to where we are today? And then you get back into this question, right? So I just think that it's a good stop to have, even putting aside the fact that people should focus more locally, because that's where the things that impact your everyday life, most of that comes from your local elected officials, right? Your county commissioners, your water commissioners, your ag commissioners, right? All of these things. But I just think that from a federal perspective, if we don't have some way to make other parts of the executive branch accountable, I just think that you run back into the same problem eventually, because if the state's power gets knocked back down, this is just another check. Is, you know, having a conversation about how do you make sure that the states retain the power that they should have is a whole other conversation, but nothing to do right now with the executive branch.
Right.
What if we propose some kind of a way to split the ticket? So, for example, Donald Trump had to put out his cabinet picks. Joe Biden had to put out his cabinet picks. And then you had the ability to vote as a whole ticket or not. Right. And so that way you know, all right, I like these people together. But you know what? It'd be great to have some diversity. Or literally, let's say that someone liked Joe Biden for president out of the options, but didn't like Joe Biden's cabinet picks. So then they voted for those on the Republican ticket just because they didn't want the agenda to go as far as it would if it was a straight ticket. Like, that is a legitimate political strategy to split up the ticket just to try and create more gridlocks because you're not in favor of the main ticket that you'd usually go for's agenda. And maybe giving them the option to do that as a check on the federal power, not to necessarily completely rein in and say all of these 20 cabinet members hold the same power as the president, but to divide it up a little bit more so that they could be a little bit of a check and provide that option. I don't know. I might be in favor of something like that.
So it sounds like a hybrid version of the current system, but like mixing in that plural system. Is that what you're suggesting?
At least giving the transparency of, I know exactly who X presidential candidate would be picking, and then they can't change it on me, right? Because a lot of times when we start getting closer to election day, presidents drop it as like a little tease, like, oh, I'm thinking about, you know, this person just to try and, you know, sweeten the pot a little bit for when you vote for them. And sometimes they do promise that. But I think that like actually making it a guarantee they cannot change their pick might create a level of transparency that would balance out the people concerning themselves more with state issues, but also being aware of what they're voting for on the federal level that their state people might have to do battle with down the road.
I can see myself compromising something like that, as long as we can guarantee that if the president actually were to win the office, like, he has to pick those cabinet positions. Like, he can't just say he's going to pick these cabinet positions for the sake of getting political points. Yep. And then once he wins office, he picks like someone completely different that fits more towards his agenda and everything like that. So if we can like guarantee something along those lines, I'd be in favor of that compromise.
So the only I hear what both of you are saying. The only thing that we haven't talked about is, let's say that we adopt this system where you name the people without changing the way, like, basically the confirmation process of the Senate. That's why, like, when I'm suggesting when it comes to the Florida system is that the Senate doesn't confirm at that point because the people are electing those positions. But in both of the conversations that we had about the other, what do you do about the Senate confirmation process? Because you could announce all the people that you want, or are you saying that when elected, because this is the pick, that's kind of like a secondary, like, approval, I guess, of that cabinet member? Is that what both of you kind of in the system would look like?
To me, yes. I think you raise a very good point. The Senate does have to confirm. That is exactly why the president can't just say, this is who I'm going to do. But again, in most instances, it's a formality, right? In the same way that it was also in most instances supposed to be the same formality for confirming Supreme Court justices. And yet we know that there's instances where that doesn't happen. And there is a real strategy where you put enough of the opposite party in the Senate, they don't confirm it. I think that making it so that they're just eliminated as that option would also eliminate a lot of the media fodder and a lot of the midterm campaigning fodder, because I feel like we shift from, instead of talking about what are the qualifications of X candidate, we shift to, those people are obstructing the presidential candidate's nomination. I feel like if we just made it to where you vote and those people are just in, we might eliminate that.
So then pretty much just leaving the confirmation process to federal judges and Supreme Court justices then at that point?
No, it would be like the ticket. So kind of like we voted for the president, we directly voted for those people as well.
No, I'm talking about for the Senate, though. Like, the Senate would only concern themselves then for, like, the federal judges and Supreme Court.
Well, for confirmation, yeah, but also let's just assume that these little toddlers could now concern themselves with actually passing legislation instead of having to worry about doing one duty a year or every 4 years.
Yeah, I'd be okay. I'd be in favor of that if you want to add that to your notes. So
yeah, I can add that.
So that'll be our proposition. So
you raised the problem, AK. Are you in favor of that kind of a solution?
Yeah. So. I guess I could be compelled, because it's not exactly what I want, but I could still be compelled to it. It's just, ultimately, I just don't trust that not having enough power rescinded from that federal, from the federal branch, especially from the president's office. I don't know if that's going to solve the problems that we have, but at least it's a step better than what we have right now. So I would agree. Try it out and let's see what happens.
Well, okay, so we're dreaming here, right? We can nuke the system and start over how we want to in this thought experiment. What would be your ideal? Because I'm not wedded to this idea. Mm-hmm. This is the best that I have in my mind right now. What would be your ideal?
Yeah, so again, my ideal would be that each of the cabinet members that exists, right, that they would be elected. Maybe we do it like 6 months after the general election, right, which is a whole other question. People are like, oh, you're doing too much, versus having it all in one general election. But my idea would be you have each of these cabinet members be elected, and they have scope, right? So if you're the attorney general, right, there is a scope of what are the defined current powers that the attorney general has, because that exists right now, right? It's just now you have the ability to elect from a national perspective. That's kind of what I'm saying, is that I would like to see a system like that. If we're wiping the slate clean, and I'm not concerned that it neuters the power of the chief commander in chief, the president, because the president has very specific roles and what they do, right? They're still the commander of the military, right? They still have all the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They still have the ability to veto. They have all of these other, powers and duties for sure. But they are neutered on all these other specific aspects of it. So that would be what it would look like for me. And we could talk about the logistics of making that happen. I know some people probably would say, well, now you're going to empower a whole other apparatus and because you have to have more people on the ballot, right? There's more names, there's more disclosures, there's all these different things. How do you handle all of this? It's just, to me, the trade-off is, if we can't fundamentally change, like if we could get rid of electing our senators, then I actually would be in favor of your guys' system, right?
Well, the thing is,
I was gonna say,
like, Ryan and I have actually already agreed, like, when we were going over with Congress, that when it comes to the senator portion, like, it was going to go back to state legislators appointee already.
So we basically reversed the 17th Amendment to where you're going to directly elect all of your state representatives, but the U.S. Senate will now be appointed by your congressional legislature.
So that's already been in place. So now that you know that.
Yeah, if I would have known that.
And your proposal doesn't sound like it's at odds with what I said, right? Like, we both said, let's have this elected. We might tweak the time frame. I'm open to that. And then also, well, we'll just kick this down the road after the, because we've got things after executive branch. We can talk about things like the different cabinets and the different, you know, three letter mafia pieces like the FBI and the CIA and things like that, and kind of reining in kind of their unsupervised powers that they currently have. So it sounded like that was more your issue, if I understood correctly, is that these cabinet members get to concern themselves with things that maybe they shouldn't be outside the scope of their duties.
Right. Because the power of the presidency is so unchecked. And so I would just kind of add this additional layer where it's not just yes men for the president, which it's the funniest thing to me. The funniest thing in the world is that Biden will go out there and he'll explain, you know, it's very important that we keep these things separated. We have no idea what the Department of Justice is doing. I'm like, oh, okay, sure. You have no idea. Like, the Department of Justice on major issues is not consulting with the White House. Like, there's no way that you really think that people believe that. I would believe it if they were completely separated and there was a larger distinction, or embrace it and say, yes, I do know this. Yep. But, like, to take this, I don't know, it's outside of my power, it's silly to me.
Well, and just to kind of illustrate some of the problems there, let's not touch the FBI or the CIA at the moment, because the argument can be made, oh, maybe we need this for national security, blah, blah, blah. Let's talk about the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. That person is appointed by the president. And then what they've done is, we recently had the Supreme Court say the EPA doesn't get to just completely destroy businesses and say you need to reach X net zero level when it comes to carbon emissions. That's not within your purview. And that's the president not doing an executive order, but executively appointing to then go and do the bidding of that person, right? And so if we opened that up to be a position that's elected, we could stop that. Then what happens is Congress, on a whole nother problematic level, circumvents this, not by saying that, you know, let's craft this legislation. They just say, well, the EPA does get to do this. but they didn't pass it with the filibuster proof majority that was actually required. And so, like, there's a lot of things that we've been pointing out as issues that circle back, and it almost converges at the issue of the president is either trying to get these things through by executively appointing, and then has the yes men in the Senate just appointing these people and confirming them, or he's passing things through actual executive order, such as we saw with the moratorium on evictions and then the student loan crisis. So it boils back down, from what I'm seeing, back to the executive and what they choose to do as far as executive orders.
So when it comes to Ryan's proposal and everything, that we're okay with the idea, because if we go with this compromise, essentially, that we'd basically be okay with the idea of, like, certain cabinet position members, if they're on the ticket, they would have the power to go ahead and basically campaign on behalf of the president and vice versa. Are we okay with that?
Yeah. I actually like AK's idea of doing it after, because here's the deal. You get a lot of ignorant voters going out who are just like, yep, I always vote Republican, I always vote Democrat, and they don't think about these positions. So making it a special election afterwards means that you're only getting the people who, you have the right to vote, but you have to take extra effort and you have to do your due diligence. And it's not just, well, I was right there to vote for the president, and then I'm like, nah, I didn't read this, I just checked because it had a D next to their name. I actually really like the proposal of doing those at a later time, because of, I think it fixes that issue.
Yeah, I could see myself coming around to that. One thing that Ryan did bring up as far as executive powers, executive action, that was actually another topic I want to touch on in this episode, because that's something that we have also seen an increase in power since really George Washington, when he first started off the executive branch and everything like that. He just really did it to establish cabinet members so he can, you know, have, like, advisors to help him out how to run the country at that point. But ever since then, we've seen an increase in power. And if the founding fathers were alive today and they saw how things were being run now, they would probably be petrified by the fact that it's pretty much become an elected monarch. Part of the issues, it used to be like to where when the executive actions were written by the president, it used to be like an enforcement of an already existing law. But then it got to a point where they got the gridlock between Congress, you know, they got impatient with it. And so they took advantage of the vagueness of the language in the executive branch in that section of the Constitution. And so they started basically like DACA, right, with Obama when he was in office. And, you know, the Republicans and Democrats, there was that gridlock. They couldn't pass like any immigration reform. So President Obama decided to go ahead and literally with a whip of a pen say, this is law, DACA, children who've been here, who came here illegal as kids and everything like that, they have the right to stay, et cetera. And the Supreme, Trump tried it to reverse. And that's one thing as well. That's also another flaw when it came to the current powers of the executive, when it comes to executive action. It can lead to a game of ping pong. There's no checks and balances to ensure, like, let's say, you know, when Trump writes these executive actions and then President Biden comes in, he can just undo everything that Trump did from the previous presidency, from the previous administration. And we want to avoid a scenario of like that game of ping pong where, you know, just because a different administration may take charge and they have a completely different ideology, they just can't go ahead and reverse the executive action that was passed. With that said, executive action should not be a law, and I think we're all in agreement with that. If anything, executive action should just be enforcement of the law. And so these are some proposals from my article, Substack, if you guys want to check it out and see the actual transcript. But these are some proposals I have written down here to kind of pretty much create more distinctions for the limits of an executive order. So really has to do with like the nature of an executive order. So the first point, my first proposal here is that the nature of an executive order can only be for the enforcement of existing laws passed by Congress. Any order that is in effect that has never been subject to debate or passage by Congress is thereby no longer valid. Based on the extent of these orders, the legal system has one presidential cycle of 4 years for a full reversal. That's the first point. Second proposal, the nature of an executive order can also be used to enforce explicit constitutional manners and Supreme Court rulings. So let's go back to the Brown versus the Board of Education when Alabama did not want to go ahead and integrate the university system and everything like that. And then President Eisenhower sent the National Guard in to enforce the Supreme Court ruling. So that would pretty much, that's what I would be protecting. The president could still do that. Third point, the nature of the reversal of an executive order can only be for causes that are not already in practice lawfully. So in other words, passed by Congress. So if there's an executive order that Biden wrote in that's not actually a law that was passed by Congress, and Trump were to come back in office, he can undo that one because it's not even a law to begin with. So that would be the first check and balance, check of power to ensure the game of ping pong is limited. Or for the practicality of the enforcement, allow for a partial reversal unless it is deemed by the Supreme Court that a full reversal must take place. Let's say Biden came into office and he was actually for securing our borders, but he has like a more efficient way to build a wall faster and anything like that versus like how the current executive action is already written by Donald Trump. He can do like a partial reversal to kind of like, he can essentially amend the executive action, but he can't outright fully reverse to where they can't, they're not building a wall anymore. Like the wall still has to be built. The nature of the reversal is really more so like amending to where, like, again, maybe Biden has a better way, faster way to build a wall or more economic way to build a wall to where it's like causing less taxpayer dollars, et cetera.
He has a less racist way, apparently, of building a wall. I don't know how that happened.
Anyways.
Okay. Can I ask you a question on one of your proposals, Ken?
Yes. Go ahead. I have one more after this.
Okay. Just going back to the first one with, it sounds like DACA would have been able to exist as an executive order under your proposal, because essentially what DACA did was it said, yeah, I'm mandating that none of these people, and Biden's kind of doing this too, are going to enforce federal laws that say you can't come into this country illegally. He's basically mandating that specific groups are left alone, which is why in part, that was problematic. And there were other aspects to that, but it sounds like since you're giving permission for them to kind of adjust the way a law is enforced, it sounds like that would still be permissible under this, right? Because he can choose to change where the law is enforced and say, well, we're not going to do this against the Dreamers and kind of shift.
Well, there's no law that explicitly outlines that was passed by Congress that allows, you know, people, my undocumented aliens to remain in the country as of right now. So DACA would not even stand right now.
Right. And he was saying that I get to carve out this amnesty.
Right. For these people. But under my proposal, Michael Bond would not be able to do that because it's not even a law to begin with. It has to be passed. It has to be passed by Congress for anyone to do anything like that. So if Obama were to do something like DACA, it would have actually gone through Congress and passed into law. And if Obama wants to enforce something like that, then at that point he would have the power. But because it was not passed by Congress originally, like DACA would not even be legal at that point.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was going to say a more recent example specifically in Florida was when Ron DeSantis removed one of the state prosecutors because the prosecutor said, I don't care that this is a law. I'm choosing not to enforce it. That's kind of what Obama did and what Biden did. So you're saying that this law would not allow them to say, I don't want to enforce a law. They can choose how a law is enforced, but they cannot elect to not enforce a part of a law.
Correct.
Okay. Just want to be sure. I'm good with that.
Yep. You have anything?
So, I was just going to say, I thought I understood what you were saying, Ken, and that made perfect sense to me because if there's a law that is, you know, goes through the entire process and becomes a bill, you know, signed by the president and becomes law, you can't choose to say, I'm just not going to enforce this law. When you make a law, you have to enforce it, which brings down a whole other rabbit hole of when talking about social enforcement of laws and things like that. But yeah. You said you had one other point.
Yeah, just one more point. One more point, and it has to do with the nature of the executive order cannot deny. And this is kind of really the result of COVID when we tried to suspend rights and everything like that. And so the nature of the executive order cannot deny nor suspend American citizens' right to basic life, to basic rights of liberty, pursuit of happiness, and the Bill of Rights. So an executive action cannot even, the president has no power to suspend rights, even for a crisis or a pandemic or anything like that. So that would be my last check and balance when it comes to executive action. Now you guys have the floor as far as your own counter proposals and everything like that. You're the guest, AK, so go ahead and come up with, if you have any counter proposals, like in the ideal world for AK, if he was the king right now and said, this is what's going to change tomorrow, what would you propose?
So I liked the majority of your proposals. The only one that I would push back on is in regards to how long the executive order can be in. And I understand that you don't want the back and forth, the ping pong action, but I actually do think that that part is important because it's not a law, that it would 100% depend on who the executive is. And so anything that would have to potentially overstay that current executive's tenure, I think should go away automatically. And the only reason I suggest that, Minnesota, our governor, and I haven't looked in other states, so I don't know if this is how other governors, how their executive orders last. But in Minnesota, when our governor signs an executive order, it is done when they're no longer the governor. And so when the new governor comes in, it's all a blank slate. They can choose to re-up other executive orders that were passed, but it's completely if they don't re-up it, all the executive orders that the governor signed, they're donezo. And so I like that because, again, it's another check. How many governors would be unelected because of an executive order that they signed? Probably not very many, but there might be some. And so I think I like that. All the other aspects I think are important that you mentioned. One, do they currently fit the scope of what the current law is? You should not be, executive order is meant to just clarify things, right? As dumb as it might sound, let's say that everyone in the FBI wears brown shirts. You want to change them to be blue shirts. You sign an executive order so everyone knows that you're getting rid of these shirts, right? So it's that's actually the purpose of the executive orders, are supposed to help clarify things that are within the power of the executive branch. to just change things within the current function. What it's turned into is like, oh yes, we are going to enforce this law, or we're not going to enforce law. We're going to allocate money to be spent from this part of the discretionary budget to this, like all of these crazy things, the current executive. But all of the points that you brought up, I am 100% down with, except like I said, I don't care about the back and forth, the ping pong, because I think it should be that way. I think that we should expect that when our executive changes, because there are term limits, like it shouldn't extend beyond that. And there might be some craziness and overturn for sure, but I'm okay with that, because if you're going to be so ambitious as to make an executive order that should extend beyond your term, you probably shouldn't make that executive order, right? And it should be able to change. And so, that also brings another part of the conversation of when we have someone that's running, if there's some executive order that, you know, the past seven executives have carried forward, and you're like, I am not going to carry forward this executive order. And you're like, oh, yeah, okay, I'm going to vote for this guy because of that, too. But, yeah, so I like your proposals. I think they're laid out very well. And I don't have actually any additions, because I think you've hit everything that mattered to me about what the current executives do.
What do you think, Ron?
I agree. I like your proposals. One of my biggest concerns with executive orders, aside from like the broad overreach that they can have, is that it allows for what might be considered a benevolent dictator, although I don't think that most of the time it's benevolent. I think they think they're benevolent, right? Because Joe Biden, with a strike of a pen, has decided to shift people's loans. It's not to say that I don't think that there's a loan crisis. It's not that I don't think there's like issues that exist. Right. But anytime you can justify something, you then claim the moral high ground and you do it, right? And like you saw this with Abraham Lincoln with the Emancipation Proclamation. To be clear, I'm not saying that was a mistake. But on the other end of that spectrum, let's talk about FDR choosing to confiscate steel mill production during World War II. Was it necessary? Yeah, sure. But then he superseded people's constitutional rights by himself. And then same for sending, hybrid Americans, right? So I don't know if that's, I don't know what the collective term is, but like you had the Italian American.
We'll just call it multiracial American.
There you go.
Multiracial.
Still 100% American. But anyway, coming from different ethnic backgrounds, he basically got to send them to an internment camp for the quote unquote good of the people. And, I think that we saw this with Trump choosing to ban bump stocks and things like that, right? They can claim that there's a crisis. They don't even have the burden of proof. And again, it's not to say that some of these weren't at times of crisis, but that's often what I hear the argument is for. We need executive orders to fix issues in a time of crisis. We need decisive action. And I'm going to be honest, I think we need a united figurehead that provides a united front. I don't think that we need, outside of declaring war, a unilateral action, right? Like, I think the president has the power to send the troops and then Congress gets to declare war. I think that in my mind, pretty much everything else can be left to individual responsibility in the states. I don't think that, sending FEMA, right, and relief and choosing where that is sent and when is fine, because again, it exists under current legislation. So to me, I think that what you've proposed there really eliminates my biggest concern, is that we have what they think is a benevolent dictator that gets to choose how to do these things. And I really just want to reduce the scope. And I think you do that, especially because with the last two, right? It needs to be explicitly lined out in the Constitution. You can't say, well, I get to limit Second Amendment rights because I can claim that it will reduce, this thing by this amount. It doesn't matter. Through Congress, like it really limits it. And I really liked that.
So let me push back. Let me go back to the game of ping pong that AK brought up, because that's a valid point as far as, the idea that when the president leaves, that should be the end of the executive power, executive action. The president that comes in afterwards should have the power and everything like that. I understand your perspective and everything like that. At the same time, though, I feel like my proposal kind of still allows room for that. Like, if let's say like the executive power left by the previous president is not a law already in practice passed by Congress first, the next president could still reverse that if he wanted to at that point. And the Supreme Court, it's the Supreme Court, if the president, let's say the previous president decides, they write the executive action, it's not even a law that was passed by Congress, and the next president comes in and wants to continue enforcing that law that's not even a law to begin with, it can either go back to the judicial branch for the Supreme Court to strike down, or it can be back left to the voters, right? The voters have the power to see, you know, as you mentioned, as far as like there's been seven different presidents that have like enforced this, you know, executive action the last, you know, for the last 20 so years. And it's not even a law that was passed by Congress to begin with. Let's get a president that's actually, you know, campaigning on actually reversing this executive action, that because it's not even a law. So I feel like it does kind of boil back down to personal responsibility. And again, I think my proposal does still allow room for that reversal in case it's just they can't reverse an executive action that's already passed by Congress, if that makes sense.
Oh, okay. So maybe I missed that part. So can you give me an example? And I know I'm throwing you on the spot. But is there an example of an executive order that you could use this definition with, that this was, you know, even hypothetical example too, you know, that's be real world, to kind of explain your point a little bit better?
I mean, DACA, right? DACA is a classic example where it was not the parameters that Obama set up. It's not even an actual existing law that was passed by Congress to begin with. And then Trump trying to reverse it, but the Supreme Court said you could not reverse that. And it's not even to say the Supreme Court didn't even get into like the constitutionality of DACA for that matter. But with my proposal anyway, like it would allow Trump to constitutionally reverse DACA essentially, because it's not an existing law already, if that makes sense.
Sure. No, I guess I'll clarify. In regards to the ping pong, can you give me a hypothetical of this is an executive order?
Like the Keystone Pipeline, when President Trump signed that when he was in office, and Biden, one of the first things he did was he reversed the Keystone Pipeline executive action that Trump did. And the American people, that's something they like. And that's something that was passed by Congress originally, if I'm not mistaken. And so that's one of those things where it was an enforcement of a law already. But because there's no checks and balances with President, as far as like what a president can do as far as reversal of an executive order, Biden was able to reverse it. And now look at our gas prices. So that's the example I can give you, you know, to as far as like a game of ping pong, where sure. If we had like Trump come back in office, now we're going to, you know, he's probably going to reinstill that enforcement of law when it comes to the Keystone Pipeline. Yeah. And then do we want to risk that chance? Like if we have another Democrat win office after Trump, do we want to risk that chance of, you know, they believe that climate change is a crisis and they reverse the Keystone Pipeline again, and we see another $4 gallon gas prices again? I personally don't want to go through that. That's just me. Ryan, you had something to say?
Well, I had a clarification question. So if I'm understanding your proposal correctly, Trump would be allowed to pass the executive order to expedite the Keystone Pipeline for whatever reason, right? Like we need more gas, we want to be more energy independent. But because, let's say, and I don't know the specifics, but let's just assume that it was passed under Congress, et cetera.
Right.
He can pass things to tweak it. Biden would not be able to reverse it because he can't, because presumably Trump did it correctly under the law. Biden can't come in and reverse something like that because we default, if we need to the law that was passed, right? He can't say you no longer get to expedite. Is that
the only correct? And the only way that Biden could reverse, the only way he could tweak that executive action by Trump is if it's actually enforcing the law itself. So he can amend the executive action if he wanted to where, like, let's say the Keystone Pipeline went through Mexico, for example, right? Hypothetically, if he wanted to. But he can't outright fully reverse the Keystone Pipeline executive action because it fits his own agenda when it's already an existing practicing law in place, if that makes sense.
Now, under AK's proposal, which I did like where you were going with this, where everything resets, kind of following the Minnesota. I think what would make that difficult is for someone who agrees with Trump's executive order there, they're not going to like that it's reversed because Biden's not going to renew it. But I mean, I think that that's going to, you know, split along party lines. So I kind of like where that it creates a little transparency where the president can't BS the way through things, right? Like Biden can't reverse Trump's executive order to limit the price, cap the price on insulin, and then do another executive order that says, guess what, guys? I just capped the price of insulin. So I think that I because he would literally have to say, I'm reviving President Trump's previous executive order to do this, or they could just pass it off as I'm doing this and you just had to pay attention. But I like that it makes it so that you can't continue what might be considered more negative things and slip it under the radar, right? Like we saw, you know, kids in cages was pinned on Trump. That goes back to Bill Clinton, right? Like, so it's like you can't just perpetuate these executive orders and be in favor of them and then be like, oh, I had no idea. So I do like that portion of it.
And I mean, I'd be open to like a compromise to go with AK's point as far as like maybe after have like a time period, like maybe after one has to be after one presidential cycle after the previous president left before they can actually reverse the executive action. I'd be open to a compromise like that. But I do like my parameter as far as like the president just can't come in and play and start the game of ping pong and reverse the executive action of the Keystone Pipeline right out of the gate. And then afterwards, you know, if we have Trump run again in office, the executive action comes back. So I'll be open to a compromise, though, as far as, you know, allowing that nuance to, you know, they can't reverse the executive action assuming office right afterwards, unless it's within those parameters. But if we allow it to where, like, after one presidential cycle goes through, then we can go ahead and allow for that, you know, reversal to take place if the president wanted to at that point. I don't know. What do y'all think about that kind of compromise?
Yeah, so in your hypothetical, here's how I hear it playing out. So let's stay on this pipeline, assuming all things that we know about it and that we said about it so far remain true. So President Trump gets in, says, Congress already voted on this, but we're just going to speed this up because, again, it's already been passed. We're going to speed it up. Maybe we're going to use X, Y, and Z to expedite this process. Biden gets in. Because Congress hasn't changed anything, Biden can't stop it. But let's say that Congress does vote and they change it and they say, yep, we're not going to do XL anymore. Then Biden can write a new executive order saying we're going to, and let's just say that the law says that we're going to end it, but they don't have specifics or timeline. And Biden says, here's my executive order. We're going to halt this thing immediately, X, Y, and Z. So I actually think that in that hypothetical, using that framework, that actually makes sense because all of those parts happening in that way I think are very difficult, which is a good thing. Like things should be difficult, right? It shouldn't be super easy to do things. So I actually do like that concept. If that's how the process works, right? That right. You just can't willy nilly because what has happened is that this is what Congress did. Biden came in and said, I don't care. It is my purview as the executive that we're going to stop these things from happening. We're going to put a moratorium on offshore drilling. We're going to put a moratorium on the amount of leases that we have on federal lands, like all of these different things that, again, might be in the purview of the Bureau of Land Management and things like that. But if Congress already said this is what's happened and the president before said we're ending these moratoriums like Trump did, right? He got rid of a lot of these moratoriums, that is what is under the current apparatus. So under those guidelines, I would kind of amend that maybe they don't have to end at the end of each term. But as long as that's the case, right, that it does stop the ping pong, but for good reason. The reason it stops the ping pong is because you can't just arbitrarily basically bypass Congress. And that's my issue 100% with executive order is that you are bypassing the will of the people. You are bypassing because when an executive, you could say, well, the president gets elected. So whatever the president wants is what the will of the people is. And that's if, fortunately, that's not supposed to be true because we don't elect a king dictator for, even if it's, you know, you say, well, there's a term limit, so they can only be king for 8 years. We don't want a king for 6 days, for 6 hours, for 6 minutes. We never want a king. And so that's always been my issue. So I think that actually would work out still. And that clarification of what the ping ponging looks like, I think is a fair reason, because it's kind of like you can't just arbitrarily for no reason stop something that's in motion because you think it's politically advantageous to you.
Mm-hmm. What if we put in the notion that so long as the president, let's say presumably, falls within the scope that we've set those parameters, right? He can't just arbitrarily reverse things. They can't just choose to cut against and execute what they're claiming is the will of the people. Trump, with the pipeline example, because of the way that it's set up with Congress, it would continue. What if we added a proposal to where Congress, because Trump worked within his confines in that instance, it's going to carry out as an executive order. You can even say it just goes into effect immediately. But then, and what if we went with AK's suggestion that it dies at the end of the presidency, assuming Congress doesn't pick it up, but we give Congress the option to where they actually have to call for a vote on whether or not to adopt the president's executive order as a part of the law. It would almost be like an amendment to the law that they passed. And it can be after a specific amount of time to see whether or not it works. But then if it continues, it's now made it even harder for the next president to try and reverse something.
I like that. I like that. I think that's a good, I think that's a good proposal for sure. Because it basically says, here's our original law. This is something that the executive said. And because that executive no longer has power to do it, is this just another way that we can make the bill, you know, if the will of the people, like, because you're going to be like, yeah, we're going to vote on this. And the people are like, this is garbage. And they're blowing up the, you know, the hotlines and the switch board and saying, don't do this. Yeah, I like that, man. That's a good proposal, Ryan.
Could you dumb it down for me? Because I kind of went over my head, Ryan.
Yeah, sure, sure. Okay, so
I got that Florida education.
Let's, just use the, let's stick with the Keystone Pipeline. So
okay.
Congress said pipeline is happening. Trump says, here's some ways we're going to expedite this. I've laid out these things for the executive orders, and this is how it's going to work, right?
Okay.
And it happens to be working. And then let's say, I don't know, within 6 months, within 12 months, Congress has to vote on whether Trump's executive order becomes a new adaptation of their law that they passed,
okay,
which then codifies it as the law.
Oh, so
for example,
okay,
it's like, all right, we're taking the pipeline these directions. There's these guidelines under here because he has the ability to execute. You know,
okay,
we're having this many jobs created here. We'll allocate this much of the budget. And then if Congress doesn't do that, it automatically dies when Joe Biden reverts to Congress's original law of the pipeline has to happen. Joe Biden can then say, I'm not giving you any more budget. But if Congress really liked, after, you know, the 6 to 12 months, they let it play out, we really like the budget President Trump put towards us. We really like the direction that he made the pipeline go. We're calling for a vote in the Senate and the House to see if this becomes the law.
Okay, I'm following. I actually like that idea. Now that I understand what you're saying,
okay,
I actually understand. I really like that proposal, that little compromise there. Because it does force Congress to do their job again, essentially, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. Congress should do their job, and the president has been doing these things. And so, like, that Supreme Court ruling that you talked about, Ryan, with the EPA, really, when you look at what the opinion is, it's like, this has become an apparatus in which if the president feels that they don't – it's not even do they have the votes, because I think they do have the votes to get through these things, but they don't want to be held accountable for the damage that it does. So it's like it goes through this mystical process, and some bureaucrat that is unelected, you can blame and say, I see the EPA, they did this thing, you know, but it's not our fault. You know, it's the EPA that did it. You know, they're just trying to do this. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, you can't do that. You can't just de facto give this power of large power to regulate things through the Clean Air Act that Congress passed, which has a very narrow scope. And now you are adding things that were not in the Clean Air Act, saying, well, this falls into it. Like when we're talking about carbon, we're talking about these different things, talking even about particulate. I can't remember, it's like the parts per million in regards to the ozone. Like, so you can reduce, you can restrict all of these industries and put all these standards. It's like, no, you cannot. That is not within your purview. That is not within your power. If you want to do that, go ahead and amend the Clean Air Act or pass a new Clean Air Act and then sign that into law. And so that's ultimately what it gets back at to is the will of the people, man. It's that simple, because that's how constitutional republics work.
Yeah, I mean, you got me. You sold me on your amendment there, Brian. So I like that parameter as far as you know, make it pretty much forcing Congress to do their job again. And especially since we already repealed the 17th Amendment and our hypothetical scenario and everything like that, like, you know, the people actually have a bigger voice now when it comes to the executive powers as far as, you know, whether or not we want to continue this executive action that President Trump, you know, set out for us. That's enforcement of law. Do we want this to actually be amended in the already existing law? Do we want to codify it? Or let's say the people decide no. I mean, the state, that point's an indirect voice of the people. Congress does a job again.
And then it also reinforces our reversal of the 17th Amendment, going back down to people should care more about their local politics that happen like every 2 years, so that they're not waiting until the fourth year rolls around when the president's in office to try and fix all this stuff, because Congress can be the check on the president that it always has been and should continue to be. And then at the local level, they vote to appoint those checks and balances, which then allow to play out every 4 years. So it lets you have more of a cycle instead of this mad rush every, you know, presidential cycle and a half.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And so I think that's like our biggest quarrel, I guess, when it came to was the reversal, the nature of the reversal of the executive action, unless anyone else has anything they want to add to these proposals or push back on.
No, that's kind of where my hang up was. And I think Ryan had a brilliant amendment here to it.
Thank you. Yeah. I think my concern, no issue with what we've talked about, but the amount of time it takes for the Supreme Court to strike something down that is as unconstitutional as we know it to be, right? Like we're setting more parameters on what is and what is not constitutional for executive orders. But what happens when we still have someone like Biden who exists here, who's like, I don't care, it's going to happen. Like what can we do without violating the Constitution or, you know, all the freedoms that we enjoy? What can we do to make sure that that doesn't just become the way we operate, where the president just says, I'm going to do it anyway, catch up?
I mean, we could do what we did with Congress, as far as if they fail to do something or if they pass a law that the Supreme Court deemed unconstitutional, they'd be on the grounds for impeachment, automatic impeachment. We could do the same thing with president if we want. That would keep president.
I like that. No, I like that. And AK, just so you know, what we did was if New York senators pass a law like they did with the Bruin decision that the Supreme Court struck down, every one of those senators who voted for that, what is deemed unconstitutional, they are up for a direct recall by the people of their state.
That's awesome.
The state.
That's a very weighty issue. Yeah. Like,
so if we,
you better be sure.
The president, yeah. If the president, then it would be a U.S. Referendum. And what is it? 3/4 of the people would have to vote to impeach him then. And that removes it from Congress being too cushy with them. And so it's immediately, if they get 3/4 vote, yes, we want this person impeached, then they're removed from office. And actually, I personally like adding that over to the executive.
Yeah, I mean, or we can make it to where like it's an automatic recall for the whole nation to for the people to vote on again, as far as like, do we want to keep this guy around who's trying to violate constitutional rights? I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to that either. What do you think?
But again, he gets.
Yeah, no, I think that's, again, I think it's a great idea, because, again, the whole point of anything about our country is that we do. It's not that we're a democracy, right? We have democratic institutions. It's that we have a constitution, and the constitution is the representative will of the people. And so that's really what matters, man. Like long as we continue to empower people, but you set up a framework that the mob doesn't just take over. And it's a very specific process. Like, hey, you did this. This was unconstitutional. The people should have a voice into saying, do they really want to have this? Because like you said, right now, what President Biden does is he knows that most likely these things will be blocked by federal judges, but he doesn't care, because he'll say, here's my executive order. I know that it probably is not going to hold up. It's going to be blocked by a court, but until it is, whatever, just like with the moratoriums, right? Like, he's like, I don't care. I'm going to extend this. Yep, it might be blocked by a judge, but then if that gets blocked, I'm just going to do a new executive order, and then it's going to take 6 months for it to get, you know, through the whole process. And that should have consequences. You can't just perpetually do that. It's like, well, no, the judge blocked it or dismissed it, and we take it to the next level. We talk about the Supreme Court is saying it's unconstitutional. There should be consequences to doing things just to basically game the system, because that's not the way that our republic should be set up. Is just push as hard as you want, because we know it's going to take a while to get things through. That's an abuse of the system. Yes.
Absolutely. So just to equip the states and the people with power, what do you think about this then? It does not have to go to the Supreme Court to be reviewed. There needs to be some kind of a process, but let's say this. Let's say we get more liberal justices who are not going to strike down Biden's thing as unconstitutional, and they just say, you know what, the good of the people, we think that this is in the best interest. Then what if we do the 3/4 of the states can call a constitutional convention? If they get 3/4 of those states that call that convention to call for an impeachment, then it automatically goes to a referendum or a recall instead of requiring the Supreme Court to be the only trigger. And it can go either through the Supreme Court and then it's an automatic potential recall, or however many states you want. I'm just thinking 3/4 would be a hefty majority that are like, this is not okay.
Yeah, I like that. No, I think that that'd be, again, and anything that continues to give power to the people that takes away power from this partisan garbage. Because, like, let's be honest, this is the conversation that we've kind of avoided. I'm a Republican. I am, but I also know that having so much power with one party creates these monsters. And the funny thing is that I've been a Republican, involved in the Republican Party since 2006. Okay, in the state of Minnesota. And I've done stuff at the federal level as well. To see the amount of turnover that there has been of people that were ardent Republicans, and I literally was asking myself this the other day. I was the chair of the Minnesota College Republicans, okay, and I had aspirations to be the national chair of the College Republicans, which it's basically you're running a 527 out of D.C. and you're lobbying to try and get money to try and help Republican candidates get endorsed. There's a lot of power and a lot of money involved in that. There are so many people that I know right now that were involved in that party, that were involved in that power apparatus, that are Democrats now. And I ask myself why, right? And it can't just be, oh, because you're young and stupid. I mean, I would have passionate conversations with these people about their ideology. What dawned on me is that it was about power. When these people saw that they were losing power, they just glommed onto the next place that they thought the power would be. And so when the establishment changes hands and it goes from this group, this family, to this group, this family, when there's no place to go, they just abandon and jump to the next place that they think someone will give them power. And that's the problem with our political system right now, is that with having these two party structures, there's actually like so many little mini parties that are organized within it. And anything that can, again, get rid of that, and what you're talking about, Ryan, and you've talked about, Ken, is that you are able to get past that. I mean, parties are going to still exist, but it gives the power back again to the people, and you can make those pleas at a local level. And that's, to me, the most important part of any of these conversations about how you kind of get this thing that's going down this terrible track, which we've been on, and saying, how can we fix it?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, a 3/4 would be like 38 states out of 50, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're already within grasp of getting the 3/4 of states to go for a constitutional convention or convention of states. So, I mean, it would be a good check and balance in power, and it gives back power to the people. So, and it forced the president to actually like make sure he walks a fine line as well, as far as like, he's not just going to start making write executive orders and ignore existing laws, or as you were talking about earlier, as far as, you know, well, I'm going to go ahead and do this executive memorandum anyway, even though I know it's going to be blocked by the federal court. And so that definitely would at least put it in the conscience of the president anyway. And that's what we also want. We want to put in the conscience of Congress to do the right thing. And we also want to put in the conscience of the president to do the right thing, where it's just no longer about power grab or, you know, shoving down a specific agenda that gives them more power, but it's actually trying to represent the people and actually protecting our rights and liberties at the end of the day. So that would be like my last soapbox for now. Anyone else?
No, I'm good.
All right.
I'm good.
AK, you want to go ahead and give your plugs for the show for our audiences to follow you?
Yeah, so I do a lot of stuff on TikTok. It's a little bit, we have a tenuous relationship right now, TikTok and I. I had a 3-day ban because, unfortunately, on TikTok, if someone mass reports you, they just go through your videos and they just click. It basically logs it. And so, long story short, follow me on TikTok, but be aware that, you know, I could get another ban and, you know, my whole thing gets taken down. So also follow me on my other socials. The best way to find me, though, is go to my Linktree. It's Linktree and then /AK Kamara, exactly how my name is, AKKAMARA. And that will connect you with all of my different socials. And that's the best way to find me. I got a new podcast I'm going to be launching. It's going to be called Black and Blue with AK and Jai, October 1st. And it's going to be about having meaningful conversations about people that get beat up in the public. And also my co-host is black, just like me. And he's also law enforcement, so it's Black and Blue. But also,
that's a great name. I love that.
It's a great thing. So yeah, stay connected with me there, and watch my content. It's funny because I don't make spicy content. Like I have funny humor stuff that I do, but like I try and keep things like, here's my reason. Here's my, you know, here's the data. Here's the story. Here's my opinion for sure. I completely interject. But I try and be above board, and I still like was getting slammed, man. But hey, you know what? My following's still growing. I've grown like 3,000 followers since I got banned, and you know now I'm back, and I was able to finally put up a video. But yeah.
I mean, I'll be in the link. Yeah, I was gonna say Ron. Go ahead, Ron. Sorry.
No, it's not. I'm sorry. The one difficult thing about not being in person is like it's very difficult to coordinate your interjections. But Ken and I getting closer. One mind. I always link the stuff below. So your link tree will be down in the description on both the live stream video as well as any of the podcast versions. So we've got
thanks, brother.
And
make it as easy as possible.
And of course, folks, make sure you hit the like button, smash the subscribe button, hit the notification bell. Even though most of us don't hit the notification bell, please, at least for Ryan and I's own ego and self-esteem, hit the notification bell. All right. With that said, folks, Ryan.
Before I close, we got to do a shout out for the music.
Yes, I forgot. My friend Devin Farley, thank you for the introduction music. And we'll get into the ticker eventually, so we don't have to always call you out every single time. But shout out to you. Credit that the soundtrack is from him. And with that said, Ryan, take it away.
All right. Remember, you can find us all on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, Twitch, and Google Podcasts. And if you follow us on our social medias, at Between the Liars and at Kenjin_Express, and then all of AK's Linktree stuff, we'll keep you posted on when we go live and what we're covering and what guests we'll have. So love to have you join us. Like Ken said, smash the like and subscribe. And if you enjoy this show, consider giving us a 5-star review. Help us. My New Year's resolution between now and next New Year's is to be at the top of the Apple charts. So remember, you can help us envision a smaller, better, more accountable government. And that starts with a blueprint. We'll catch you here next week.